I'm not playing tricks with the title of this sermon. I'll tell you from the very beginning that life's greatest enemy, in my opinion, is life. Too much of it. I believe the editorials and essays and books that tell us that unless the present population explosion is controlled, the world faces an ecological catastrophe of unimaginable proportions. Not tomorrow, nor the next day, you and I will make it, but sooner for others than we would wish if we are caring, responsible people. Science and technology can still give us some help with new food supplies and substitutes for the natural resources we are destroying, but they too will be overwhelmed if we let population growth go unchecked for another 100 years. It doesn't matter how many Earth summits we have in places like Rio, if we ignore the root problem, which is overpopulation, while all the other problems become less and less manageable, and our efforts to save this apparently unique planetary lifeboat are doomed to failure. I have no reason to doubt the statistics I read everywhere. Plant and animal species extinguished every single day as human beings crowd them out and terminate the fascinating results of millions of years of slow evolution. Carbon monoxide flooding into the atmosphere at the rate of 6 billion tons a year. 6 of the 7 warmest years on record occurring since 1980. Forests disappearing at the rate of 40 to 50 million acres a year. Think about it. 6,000 acres cut down in the hour we spend in worship this morning. And behind this sobering scenario, the reason for it, world population growing by 92 million people every year. Figures are abstract, sometimes unexciting, so let's give the numbers a face. Each year, we create another Mexico to feed 92 million more human beings. Or to put it another way, while we sing and pray and listen for 60 minutes this morning, 10,500 more people came into life on this planet. I remind you, by the way, that only 30 years ago, Mexico had 25 million people. As it approaches 100 million in such a short time, you can understand why so many of its desperate people cross our borders every year in search of a better life. We like the United Nations when it votes for sanctions against a Saddam Hussein. We yawn when it estimates in its State of the World Population Report for 1992 that we will jump from a little over 5 billion people on Earth today to nearly 9 billion in another generation, with 90% of that increase coming from third world countries already strained to the breaking point by poverty and shrinking resources. You would think that one of our highest priorities might be population control. When President Bush was still a congressman from Texas, and later when he was our ambassador to the United Nations, he was an advocate of world population control. Under pressure now from a voting bloc that does not believe in family planning and contraception, he has altered that stance. In 1989, both houses of Congress voted to restore support for the UN Population Fund. Mr. Bush vetoed the bill. The issue of population explosion was on the initial agenda in Rio, but criticism from the Vatican and other strongly Catholic countries caused it to be dropped, and our own administration, in the meantime, backed away from America's traditionally strong support for family planning, cutting financing for International Planned Parenthood and the UN Population Fund, the world's two largest planning bodies. And so we race pell-mell from our 5 billion now, already in trouble with diminishing resources, toward the 9 billion of the year 2025, when your children or grandchildren will live in a world infinitely more overcrowded than this one. When the priestly class of ancient Israel wrote the great creation hymn we now find on the first page of our Bible, the world was not a crowded place. So the song says, "Let the waters teem with countless living creatures." And it says, "God blesses the fish and birds and bids them multiply." And then says to the human creation, "Be fruitful and increase, fill the earth and rule over the fish and birds and all living things." It made wonderful sense to have God sanction fertility at a time when infant mortality was high and lifespans were limited by disease and famine, but one can hardly imagine the same writers saying such things in a time like this, when fertility for multiplied millions means a lifetime of grinding poverty and ignorance. We are asked in the first epistle of Peter to be good stewards of the manifold grace of God. If the soon to come 21st century needs a rallying cry, that would make a good one. We know now what those priestly authors of Genesis 1 did not know, that the planet we live on is not just a casual mix of air blanket and rolling seas and lands of ice and forest and desert, but a unity, a living organism of interrelated parts. To us, having seen it from space, it looks far more fragile and lovely than any generation before us could have imagined. There is nothing else like it within reachable distance in the endless dark of space. So we love it in ways people have never done before, and we abuse it in ways no one could have dreamed possible in the centuries when our sacred book was being written. When Isaac Asimov wrote more than 20 years ago that our swarming human population qualifies our species to be called an ecological cancer. He was dismissed by most people as a doomsday prophet of fantasy. But the figures we have to deal with now make the cancer analogy seem much more appropriate. Individual cells multiplying so rapidly in the organism we call Earth that they will, if we do not slow them down, destroy it as surely as spreading cancer cells destroy a human body. The phrase population explosion is not merely sensational rhetoric, overblown and overwrought. I ask you to consider this for a moment. Back in the days of Julius Caesar, not very long ago, in terms of the Earth's total history, a population estimated at 150 million was growing at a rate so slow that it would take 1,000 years to double it. Today, with over 5 billion people, we are growing at a rate that, if it holds, will double that number in 35 years. Not in 1,000, when none of our descendants will remember us, but in 35 short years, when our children and our grandchildren will wonder why we were willing to let the cancer go unchecked. Someone is thinking, "Come on, Robert, you're too pessimistic. Haven't we always fixed our problems? Sooner or later, science will find a way to clean up what we pollute, replace the wasted resources with substitutes, find new food, new fuel. Human ingenuity is extraordinary. We'll handle it." Perhaps in a few places, for a while, it may be true. On a global scale, I don't believe it. Resources are, after all, ultimately finite. People in some parts of the world already must eat the seeds they meant to plant, cut down trees for fuel, and turn their land slowly into desert. Slaughter for food, animals they once would not have touched, including animals they need to provide food of other kinds and to do domestic work. We may like to watch nature documentaries and go on safari to see the exotic animals, but we should never doubt for a moment that people whose children are starving will kill every last one of those animals in order to sustain their own lives, exactly as we would. And suppose we might, through desperate technology, find ways to feed the teeming billion scheduled to occupy this life ship of ours if the population explosion continues. Would the life be worth living? Even if we can actually find the will and the resources and the expertise to float cities on the surface of the oceans or submerge them on the floors of continental shelves, even if we put algae farms on the roofs of all the high-rise buildings in the world to provide protein for the incredible masses of people, would such a crowded life be tolerable? There are signs already that we are not immune to the psychoses that afflict laboratory animals kept squeezed too tightly together. I have never been much of a gloom and doom forecaster. My reading of history tells me that through most of the human adventure, we have improved life. In the very week when I worked at this sermon, I did some reading in the ways of English life in the 18th century, and I marveled at a note that put infant mortality at 74 out of 100 births in 1749. 3 out of 4 children dead before they got fairly started. By half a century later, this had improved so much that only half the children died. Better medicine, improved health care and sanitation, we kept more and more people alive and began to create, ironically, an even greater problem. I can believe faintly in the possibility that something extraordinary may happen to cancel my worries about the population explosion. I just don't know what it is. What I do know is that despite all the advances that have made my life so comfortable, the planet I live on has been fouled in ways and magnitudes no human being has ever seen or imagined before. And it threatens to get much worse unless we solve our biggest single problem: too much life for the life support system. It might change if we get serious. People are writing and speaking these fears all over the world, and somewhere among the listeners may be the very men and women who will save us from ourselves. The Catholic Church, for which I have so much respect, for so many contributions to civilized life, may yet decide that contraceptives are preferable to planetary suicide. That church, after all, yielded in times past to other pressing realities and changed its doctrinal stance. Perhaps it will again. None of us, by the way, would want abortion as a way of limiting the population explosion. What we hope is that those who march under the banners of right to life and pro-life will see that unless we decrease the number of conceptions and in that way the number of births, the debate over abortion will become an insignificant whisper in the war for food and living room. I would guess that almost everyone present accepts the notion that at some point we shall have to limit the number of bodies we put on this finite planet. If birth control has to come, and by, for sheer survival's sake, why not work for it now? While in Asimov's poignant plea, there are still oak trees in the world, and daisies, and tigers, and butterflies, and while there is still open land and space, and before the cancer called man proves fatal to life and the planet. Here's an odd little sign of the times. For over 50 years, the Allwood Gardens in Dayton, Ohio, have been open to the public without charge. There had never been an incident of vandalism. until this year, a brand new sign at one entrance to the garden was smashed by somebody whom it must have offended. In an English translation of an old Portuguese verse found throughout the forests of that country, the sign said, "Let no one say, and say it to your shame, that all was beauty here until you came." We have a beloved song that asks God to shed His grace on the land where we live. I've asked the choir to sing the first two verses, after which we will stand and join them in the last verse. And as we sing that verse, let's widen the prayer to include the whole earth.